ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Love books? Listen to The Book Show or The Bookshelf, or hey, why not both?
Then we want to find out more about you. Tell us what you're reading, how you choose your next great read, and what book podcasts you listen to.
Whether you read one book a year or one a week, your feedback will help us make better programs for you and your mates.
So tell us about your reading life.
Find the link to our short survey in the show notes for The Book Show or The Bookshelf.
Hello, I'm Claire Nichols. So great to be with you for The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction writers. Today, I'm going to take you to outer space with the acclaimed Aussie author Garth Nix. But do you know what's just as dramatic as a trip to space? Well, it could be a group of Sydney school mums and a severed finger, because we are going back to the beaches of Big Little Lies with Leanne Moriarty. I'm sure you remember Big Little Lies. It was the book that gave us a bunch of posh kindergarten mums and embroiled them in a murder investigation. It was, of course, adapted to the hugely successful American TV series Big Little Lies, starring Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman. And there was a second series of that show too, where Meryl Streep was brought in as the mother-in-law from hell. But Leanne Moriarty, well, now she is bringing the story back to Sydney with a sequel to the novel Big Little Lies. It is set 10 years after the first book. And I've got to tell you, I absolutely devoured this. We have the same set of mums. Of course, there's a new crime to be solved. But one of the reasons this works so well for me is Leanne Moriarty's laser-sharp powers of observation. It feels like she is writing a world she just knows so intimately, the politics of high school, the dramas of the school WhatsApp group, the trials of the sandwich generation, Sydney's coffee culture. It's all there. Leanne Moriarty, welcome.
Hello, thank you so much.
And Leanne, of course, the sequel to Big Little Lies has to be called
Big Little Truths. Although you say that, and we had a lot of trouble coming up with that title.
Really?
Yes. Oh, we went from, I think for a long time I was calling it Bigger Lies, then Giant Little Lies, and then all of a sudden, yeah, we came up with Big Little Truths, and then it seemed obvious, which means you've got the right title.
Of course. How long have people been asking you for a sequel for Big Little Lies?
Oh, well, almost from the moment it came out, because I can remember getting a message from Reese Witherspoon when they were planning, you know, the show was in development, and she was saying, oh, people are asking, is there any chance of a sequel? And I remember saying, no, absolutely not, because I don't write sequels. And I said, I'm so sorry, I'm not going to be like the Game of Thrones guy. So for a long time.
Well, what's the aversion been to sequels?
Well, I had a standard line, I would say, that I had put my characters through so much that I wanted to leave them in a happy place, which wasn't just a line. That's how I felt, and that I was now interested in creating a whole new set of characters.
Mm. Of course, you have had to think about these characters and what comes next for them already, because with the TV show Big Little Lies, there was a second season and you had to come up with a novella for that book. That, of course, is not what this novel is, though, right,
Leanne? No, that's right. So I called it a novella because I was meant to be writing a sort of a treatment, but I didn't know how to write without writing a story. So I ended up writing 50,000 words for that. And that, to me, felt quite different. It wasn't. I was writing that in an American accent. So I was writing for the characters. And I felt quite proud of myself for doing this, I changed some of the backstories from the book to suit the show. And now I deeply regret that. So I was just thinking, how could there be another season? And I was just writing it scene by scene. So in a way, it was fun because one of the hardest things of writing a novel is that you have to move your characters around. And writing that, I could just say, this happened, this happened, this happened. But then once it was done, and I never mind when they change my book for the adaptation because the book's still there. But with this, I didn't like it because it sort of, that novella disappeared. So it sort of clarified that I'm a novelist. Mm. Having said that, I did love the fact that I wrote a role for Meryl Streep, sort of with my own secret little plan, and called a character Mary Louise, which is Meryl Streep's real name. And yes, I got Meryl, which I couldn't believe.
And so now you're in this really interesting position, right, with the sequel to Big Little Lies, the novel.
Mm.
So, you have to deal with what you've done for the TV show, where you set that second series immediately after the events of the first book. You introduce a character like Mary Louise.
Mm-hmm.
Do you then have to take everything you've done in that TV world and incorporate that into the sequel that you're writing, which is set back in Sydney 10 years later?
Well, firstly, thank you for appreciating the the logistical challenge here. Well, firstly, the book has to follow from the book. So that's the first rule. So it's still set in Australia. Anything that happened in the book has to have still happened in this world. And the fact that, for example, some things happened in the show, like Madeline had an affair. My Madeline would never have had an affair. So I just ignored that sort of thing. But then because I created that role of Mary Louise for the second season, I wanted her in this book. I don't think I would have ever put, if David E. Kelly, who wrote the adaptation, if he had created an entirely new character, I would not have wanted to bring that character into the book. But because I felt that Mary Louise was mine, I brought her into this book. And the other challenge was also that I felt that some readers, and that even I, could sort of see some of the characters, the television versions.
Yeah.
So as I was writing, I could see my Celeste and I could see Nicole Kidman's Celeste. So Reese Witherspoon has blonde hair. My Madeline has dark hair. Therefore, in Big Little Truths, I just avoided describing Madeline's hair just so that I didn't then bring the reader out of this fictional world. So it's a really strange, I don't know, I guess some novelists would find this very peculiar and not right. But it's just two fictional worlds colliding. And you never want, when you're writing a novel, you want the reader to suspend their disbelief. So you can't do anything that brings them out of the novel, that makes them suddenly aware this isn't real. It was tricky but fun.
I remember when we met up in Sydney last year, you telling me about the fact that you'd forgotten about one of Madeline's kids, her son, because he'd been taken out of the TV series.
That's right.
You know, he was a not necessary character for the TV series. So writing the sequel, was it nice to bring him back to life again?
Yeah, I did. Well, I did consider doing something really meta because I'd forgotten him. And I was thinking, should I put Fred in his bedroom just playing video games all day long and have a character say, it's like Fred doesn't even exist, isn't it? And then just forget about him. But I sent him off to America, to university. It was nice, but it's also, I have too many characters in my books, and I know I do. I can't seem to help it. So it was nice, but I was happy to send him off. one because I don't want to confuse readers anymore.
Yeah, so maybe David E. Kelly was right with that one.
Yes, I think he probably was. Poor Fred, though.
Poor Fred. So this is set 10 years after the events of the first novel, Big Little Lies, and Big Little Truth starts with a gruesome delivery to the high school in Piriwee. Mm. Mm. What arrives at the school?
A severed finger arrives at the school for, and I apologise because it sounds terrible when you say this sort of thing out loud. But that's what happens.
Maybe you can read a little bit of this for us.
Sure. Within the hour, the entire school community was aware that someone had sent the principal a severed finger. Any doubts about the veracity of Reuben's story disappeared when a police car was seen driving into the visitors' parking area. Phones across the Piriwee Peninsula vibrated ecstatically with the ping, ping, ping of parent WhatsApp group notifications. These were caring, involved, hands-on parents, many of whom could have sent their children to private high schools but chose not to for worthy ideological reasons, so were therefore entitled to VIP treatment for not spending the money they could so easily have afforded to spend. All they asked was transparency. If a severed finger had been sent to the school, they should be informed without delay. Their children, meanwhile, were euphoric about this ghoulish interruption to their day, although some experienced nausea, and the theatre kids, who felt things deeply, wept and fainted, or did their best to faint. It was one of those days from their childhood every student would remember, that sunny spring day when somebody gave their school principal the finger.
That's Leanne Moriarty reading from her novel Big Little Truths, the sequel to Big Little Lies. And you can hear just how funny this book is. Leanne, what did you want to explore about high schools and high school politics?
Well, I never set out when I'm writing a book to thinking, okay, I am going to explore this particular theme or this particular issue. Things just emerge as you write. I guess when I first wrote Big Little Lies, I was very aware that becoming a school parent was like becoming part of a small village, which is the perfect setting for any sort of novel. You always want a confined setting. You know, that's why Agatha Christie puts people in an old manor house. And so I guess, just the idea that you're part of a community, which means there's lots of potential for both conflict and humour.
Mm. And it's different, right? In high school, it all changes because the dramas are not the same.
Exactly. Is that where you are now? Have you got?
I'm still in primary school years, we're still very hands-on. And I did get a bit anxious reading Big Little Truths and having the parents worrying about vaping and dating and lying. I'm scared.
Yes, I'm sorry. It's not as bad as all that. But yes, you're not. When you're in primary school, you're in charge of organising the play dates and that sort of thing, whereas the parents are a really important part of your life. But when you're in high school, they're making your own friends, and I guess you hold on then to the friends you made in primary school, if you're lucky. So it's a different world, but you still need each other because you need to hear, what do you know, what's going on?
I laughed out loud at many points in this book because just like in Big Little Lies, you have these other moments that make up the text. So you have interviews, unlike in the first book when it was interviews with parents, this time it's interviews with students at the school. But you also have transcripts of the Year 10 parents' WhatsApp chat. I laughed and cringed in equal measure. I'm just wondering, Leanne, for those who have not experienced the exquisite torture of being in a parent's WhatsApp chat, what are these places like?
Well, first of all, I need to say that a parent WhatsApp group can save your life with important information. I am incredibly grateful for the parent WhatsApp group. It's just funny. So for example, if somebody loses something, and this is something that I think women do, that somebody says, my child's lost their such and such, then all helpful women say, I haven't seen it and neither have I. And and my husband, who's on the WhatsApp group, is saying, you don't need to tell us that you haven't got it. Just but they're being pleasant. They're being friendly and sympathetic.
Oh, but meanwhile, your phone has not stopped dinging for 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. It's ding, 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 ding. So it's really funny. And sometimes there's a tiny bit of conflict. And in my book, then, you ramp it up.
Yeah, so watch out, parents. Leanne is watching the chat and using it for fodder for her book.
Yes.
And our key characters in this novel, the women from the first book, they're all a decade older, most of them now in their 50s. How's this phase of life treating our characters?
Well, I think the 50s are an interesting time because, yes, you've got often you've got teenage children, you might be dealing with elderly parents, you might be facing, as a woman, you might be facing hormonal issues while your teenagers are facing their own hormonal issues. So it's just a time of your life where there's a whole lot going on.
And my favourite character in both books is Madeline. She really is the heart of this group of mums, larger than life. For those who need a visual clue, it's played by Reese Witherspoon in the TV series. She turns 50 right at the start of this book. What's her life like now?
Well, she's sort of dealing with the fact that she's facing an empty nest soon and she's wondering what that's going to be like. Her oldest daughter is in her mid-20s with a new boyfriend who is suspiciously perfect, and she has an elderly mother and also an ex-husband. So she's got a lot going on, and then I give her a whole lot more. And yeah, I feel bad about that, but this, unfortunately, that's what sometimes happens in life, that one thing goes wrong and then all the dominoes come crashing down.
Yeah, and we can't really spoil what's going on, but there is a lot in store for Madeline. What I liked, though, is she's very worried about what her relationship with her husband's going to look like when their last child leaves the home. Mm. You know, are we going to spend time together? Are we going to have sex? And there's a great moment where she says, where she thinks she should never have let him see her putting on shapewear. Nothing kills a vibe like trying to put on a pair of specs, surely.
Yeah, I forgot. That's so funny when you say sometimes I just completely forget writing that line, which is one of the fun parts of writing when you look back and you, you can't even remember writing it. So I think I got that. There's that British comic, Michael McIntyre. Mm-hmm. He does this great scene with about his wife putting on stockings. It's hilarious. He says it starts out very sexy and then it becomes very odd.
There's a bit of jumping around and wiggling.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And he sends it up so perfectly.
I did get so much joy from this book. I loved hanging out with all these women 10 years later. There's a brilliant scene where they're all just burst into tears in a car. There's another beautiful scene where they do an impromptu pedicure for one of the women who's having a tough time. And it feels weird to say this, Leanne, because this is a book that starts with a severed finger and there is a lot of darkness in this book, but I did feel like there was a lightness of touch. There was a joy to Big Little Truths. And I'm wondering, was it as pleasurable to write as it is to read?
Well, the logistical challenges that we talked about earlier, I didn't enjoy that, but there were lots that I loved about it. So I loved writing the teenage characters because I'm in that world now, and I love teens. Of course, they also present challenges, but I adore them. So I had so much fun with those characters. And with the friendship, which was so important in the first book, and I find that as you get older, your friendships only deepen. And I'm finding with my friends that there's a new gratitude for each other, that we're not just taking it for granted, because as you get older you realise, you've lost people, and, there's just a real depth to your friendships. And maybe the fact that I felt myself that I was reuniting with these old friends too. So I loved that. And I hope that readers feel the same way, that they experience that. And I have humour in all my books, even though I'm exploring often very dark themes, and I'm just trying to get that balance right. Because that's what life is like, that we're all laughing hysterically at the during the most dreadful time of your life. I'm sure everybody's got a story like that about planning a funeral where there's a lot of laughter in between the tears.
Yeah. I always marvel at the way you plot your novels, Leanne Moriarty. It's really actually incredible the way we see the finger arrive at the school, then we're going back in time, we're seeing the moments that have led to this, but we're also following the investigation into the finger, and it all comes together so beautifully at the end. You make it seem effortless on the page, but I'm sure it's not. How hard is it to actually get that together structurally?
Oh, yes, it's tricky. And so, for example, things like, I did not know when I first started writing this novel that there would be a severed finger. So I was well along the way when I came up with that. So it means I'm constantly going back and forth, and because I don't have it all set out before me, so I don't know how it's going to end. And as I work it out, that means then I can go back and I have to then add in the red herrings. Mm. I think, oh, well, now that can't happen, or now this has to happen. Now I have to misdirect the reader. So it's a lot of, I'm always very aware of the fact that even though I don't plan, I don't want to give the impression that it just all falls perfectly into place. And then I'm very grateful for the editorial process, because that's when another or many sets of eyes look at it and say, well, this doesn't make sense. That's again where it's so important, that because readers are incredible, and if they see anything that doesn't make sense, then again they can't suspend disbelief anymore, because then they think, nope, this does not work. Therefore, somebody wrote it and they made a mistake when they wrote it, and now I'm no longer in this story.
This book, Big Little Truths, are we going to see this adapted for the screen, Leanne?
Yes, I believe so. It's very much in development, and the hope is that they'll start filming it sometime next year.
How incredible. And then this story goes back to America again and fits into that universe as well as this one here in Sydney.
Yes, and you know what, that's where the screenwriter, who is Francesca Sloan, I hope I've got that right, and so her challenge will be, it has to follow on from the show. Yes, so it will be tricky. She'll have her own logistical challenges.
Mm. Has this project made you rethink your idea about sequels?
Possibly, yes, because with a time jump, I really loved the fact that there was a big time jump. I don't ever want to finish a novel and then say, and then 1 week later. Mm. I think that's where I wouldn't like it. But I did really enjoy it. So, yes, I'm not going to be doing my line about Noel. I'll leave my characters on their own. And with this one, it was so interesting seeing them at a different stage of their life. So now I am thinking, the first book begins on Madeline's 40th birthday. This one begins on her 50th. So what about what happens on her 60th birthday, especially as I'm about to turn 60 in a few months' time. So, yeah, I'm not finished with them yet.
Oh, well, happy birthday for a few months' time, and congratulations on this novel. I really enjoyed it. It's called Big Little Truths, and it's published by Macmillan. Leanne Moriarty, thank you.
Thank you so much, Claire.
You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National.
And the Australian author Garth Nix is here. He is hugely successful in the young adult fantasy space, particularly beloved for his Old Kingdom series, which started with the novel Sabriel. But now Garth Nix, he's stretching himself in new directions. He has his first ever adult science fiction novel. It's called Massive, and get this, it involves soldiers living on massive mountain ranges travelling through space. Hi, Garth.
Hi, Claire.
Garth, I didn't know before you were a writer, you were once a military man.
Well, only a part-time one. I was in the Army Reserve for 5 years from 17 to 21, which was something that I had friends who were in the Army Reserve, and also I had planned to become a regular Army officer. And I actually really enjoyed it, and it was a very formative experience and very useful for me as a writer later on. But it also convinced me that I didn't want to join the regular Army, that I didn't want that whole life, as it were. I became aware that it really is it is an entire lifestyle in a way, and that I wanted something different, though I did very much value my time in the Army Reserve and the friends I made there and the things that I did on many levels, even when they were very difficult or dangerous. They certainly rounded out my character, as it were, and, as I said, helped me a lot as a writer in all kinds of things, both small and large.
Well, can you give me an example of how that Army experience has informed your writing?
Well, I do like to base things very much on reality. So even when writing fantasy or writing science fiction, I try and build up my fantastical stuff on a foundation of reality. So real things, often, you know, drawn from history or from geography or the natural world or whatever, but also from my own experience. So there are things that, you know, there might be like the minutiae of military courtesy, which I certainly draw on in Massive, the oddities of military administration and bureaucracy, but also things like, even in my earlier books, writing about characters being, for example, there's a sequence in Sabriel, you know, written a long time ago, it first came out in 1995, where she's pursued through the snow by a terrible monster called a Mordekaiser. Now, I've never been pursued through the snow by a terrible monster made of grey mould and blood. But I did do an escape and evasion exercise in the Army Reserve, where I was pursued over 24 hours as an exercise with nothing. But I drew upon that feeling of being pursued and trapped and not being able to find my way out, and also being defenseless against the people who are after me, essentially. So I drew upon those quite raw emotions. So I found things like that very useful. But also, I mean, again, particularly for Massive, just how, you know, soldiers get along with each other. I never base any of my characters upon any one real person, but I do draw upon bits and pieces from real people to create my Frankensteinian characters, I guess. So certainly some of the characters, particularly in Massive, I draw upon some of the guys in my platoon who were some very interesting characters, and I've only taken little bits and pieces from them, but certainly it's all raw material. So sometimes people think, you know, if you write fantasy or you write science fiction, none of it is drawn from real life. But actually, to make it work, to make people relate to it and to feel it, you need to have a very strong foundation of reality, real people, real characters, no matter what environment they're in and no matter how fantastical or science fictional it is. I think you need to start with real people.
So you take that foundation of reality and then you put them on a floating mountain range in space.
Yeah, exactly. But then you have to think, how would that affect them? You know, how would that affect, how would I be if I was on this this mountain in space, which is really a kind of alien intelligence, and it's not necessarily entirely benign either. It's somewhat benign. It's given us gifts and it's taken us to the stars, which is the basic idea of the book, that, you know, humans have hitched rides on these star-faring mountains, and it's enabled us to go out into the galaxy and to colonize other worlds, which we need to do because we've stuffed up the Earth so badly. But why are they doing this? And that's the core of the book, I guess, is, you know, on one level, it is a military science fiction story about the small crew of a ship and how they're surviving, what they're doing, and they're caught up in a human war because, of course, being humans, one of the things we've used the Massives to help us do is export our wars out to the galaxy. So on one level, it's a story of that crew and just trying to stay alive and fight their war. But behind that, there is the whole enigma of the Massives. You know, why are they carrying us to the stars? What's in it for them? What is the nature of the strange avatars that each of the Massives have? And that's all tied up in the story as well.
I'd love for you to read to us from the start of Massive, just so you can really set up this
sure.
really fantastical idea that underpins this novel. Would you read from the first
Absolutely.
Page for me?
Absolutely. Though I just realised as I was about to read this that I never looked up the pronunciation of the initial Massive in Madagascar. so that maybe I'll get it wrong, but we'll find out. In 2096, a little girl went missing from a village in the foothills of the Marajeji Massif in Madagascar. 4 months later, on March 11th, 2097, the entire mountain range lifted off into high orbit. Within 4 months, the first expedition arrived at the now orbiting Massif. Their ship lost all electronic function as they approached and should have crashed, but was landed safely by unknown forces on a lake that had not existed when the Massive was on Earth. It was quickly discovered there was Earth-equivalent atmosphere and gravity in the valley around the lake, and the Tychonauts were greeted by something which had the appearance of the missing girl, Marina Rakoto, but was quickly found to be something else, at the cost of one overly aggressive person's life. Other expeditions followed. Limited contact was established with the entity who became known as the Massif's avatar, Marina Rakoto. It gave gifts to some of the visitors, ships that became known as Basics, and it informed them the Massif would eventually leave for another star system, but would one day return.
That's Garth Nix reading from the prologue of Massif, and this image of this mountain range taking off and heading into orbit, and there being all these mountain ranges, you know, travelling through space and intersecting with each other. It's so arresting, Garth, and so unusual. Where did it come from?
Well, I guess unsurprisingly, it all did start off with, I guess, a vision or an imagining of an entire mountain range taking off into space, just pulling out of the ground and rising up and slowly ascending into orbit until it's just a little speck in the sky and then out of sight altogether. But I have no idea where that came from. Many of my stories start with a single image, kind of like a frame cut from a film, sometimes with a character, sometimes it's just a scene. And then I think about it, well, what is this? What does it mean? Where is the story here? And that is the case with Massive. I had this idea of this whole mountain range lifting off into space, going into orbit, and then I had to think, well, what is it? Is it a spacecraft? Is it just a mountain? What would make that happen? And eventually, you know, over time, I arrived at the idea that it is essentially an alien spacecraft, and it is governed or represented by an avatar. There's only one that comes from the Earth, and that's the avatar is Marina Rakoto, the little girl. All the other Massives have different alien avatars, and in fact, most of the book takes place on a massive called Drummer Boy, and the avatar on Drummer Boy is a perpetually drumming sort of hamster-like creature, but about a 7 foot tall bipedal hamster.
Yeah, pretty normal.
Yeah, pretty normal, but also very frightening because it drums people to death sometimes. And now there's a lot of arbitrary stuff, and humans just don't understand. I guess part of science fiction is a very broad genre, and there's all kinds of things you can do within it. I'm kind of mixing or blending a large number of the things that I like about science fiction in this book, which is, I guess, something I always do. I always write the story that I want to read myself, regardless of what it is. So Massive, on one level, is a military science fiction novel. It's also a space adventure. It also has elements of science fictional horror. There's a lot of things going on. And then, of course, the idea of the Massives themselves is the classic kind of one single big idea, which is, again, another part of science fiction. So I've taken these elements that I love and found my story by blending them together.
One of the features of life on this Massive is that modern technology doesn't work. So, there's no internet, there's no AI. All these things that we are used to in our world are not there. What was the joy of writing a world where you have to go old school?
It was partly joy and partly pain because I had to do so much research. And I'd made the decision from the beginning that this would be the case. The Massives don't allow more modern human technology and, extrapolated human technology, because this is 300 years in the future, because they don't want humans to be able to figure out what's going on within the Massives. So I made that decision, but then I had to do a lot more research than I normally have to do, because it's all tube-based, basically World War II technology, nothing past of 1945. And every time I'd think, okay, well, the radar has to work like this. It has to be cathode tube-based, radar. What does that mean for this other technology? What does it mean? How does radio work when there's this killing field around the basic spacecraft? So I had to actually do far more research and actually ask knowledgeable people, how would this work if this in these circumstances, which is not something I'm used to. So yes, that was the pain part. I also did enjoyable research along the lines of reading novels that were written in World War II. One example is The Cruel Sea, by Nicolas Montserrat, which I think is one of the best. It's one of the best novels ever written about the war at sea in World War II. And one of the reasons it's so great is, all the naval detail and so on is perfect because it's very autobiographical to a large degree. But it's also it's about the people, and that's what makes it a great novel. The background of the Atlantic War and the life on two different ships is essential that it be got right, but that's not the story. The story is all the people. It's the selected crew members that Montserrat, shows their life and loves and interactions. So that was both a big influence and also I was pleased to have an excuse to read it again.
And I should say the central crew in this novel, Massive, you will fall in love with them. They're a great group of people. They're super dedicated to each other, and they are super dedicated, Garth Nix, to cups of tea. I don't think I've seen so much tea drinking in a novel for a long time.
Well, I guess that's probably, again, the sort of influence of Montserrat and others and a long tradition, I guess. And actually, even Patrick O'Brien and his Master and Commander books, which I also love, and I think they're, on one level they are military history, but of course they are brilliant character studies and also a brilliant look into life in the late 18th, early 19th century and the Napoleonic Wars and so on. But what makes them so good, are the characters. But all through those books, there's a lot of concern about drinking coffee. Coffee is a huge thing in those books. there's this whole business, which is quite historical, of ships that only drink coffee and ships that only drink cocoa. And the massive disappointment of Jack Aubrey at one point where he's rescued, I think, but only to find himself on a ship that only serves cocoa and he's a coffee fiend. So I guess, you know, I'm sort of extrapolating on that. But also, even again, from, you know, my time in the Army Reserve, you know, I brew up, make a cup of tea, that was always just part of the daily life, but certainly a part of daily life that was very welcome. Time for a brew up.
Well, maybe pour yourself a cuppa and settle down with Massif. It is published by Allen and Unwin. Garth Nix, great to chat with you today.
Great to talk to you too. Thank you.
Now, maybe you are planning to read Massif by Garth Nix. Perhaps you're more inclined to read Big Little Truths by Leanne Moriarty. Whatever it is, tell me what you're reading. You can email The Book Show at thebookshow@abc.net.au. That's thebookshow@abc.net.au. Do make sure you're following The Book Show on ABC Listen. The show is produced by Sarah Lestrange, and we make this program on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.